Hello and welcome. We'd like to bring you into our discussion on our current topic for our Economics 490 capstone class. This topic will discuss the economics of recession and what does it mean to you. We have a panel here that is going to discuss about six questions. First of all, we'd like you all to know that the media services that we're using here today will be available to any student at Humboldt State who wants to use this for their capstone project. My name is Dawn Camille Abdul-Albari. I am an economics major, and I'd like to introduce the panel at this time. I'll be discussing these questions. It's Ms. Brooke Siegel, and she is an economics major. We have Dr. Eric Eschker. He is our department chair. We have Dr. Michael Dennis. He is also associate professor in the department. And we have Mr. Arthur Osorio, who is also an economics major, and we will be addressing questions today. So I want to go ahead and move right to our first question, and I'm going to start with you, Brooke. And the first question is, what is a recession, and if we're currently in a recession, what does it mean to you?
We talk about a recession as being two consecutive quarters of negative GDP, and there's a lot of other things that contribute to a recession, employment and income, and such, and looks like we might be in a recession now, and what that means to me as a graduating senior, the job market and looking for jobs in May in a couple months.
All right, very good. Dr. Eschker, would you like to chime in on this one?
Well, this might be important to Brooke and Arthur and some of the other students graduating Humboldt State. What you tend to find is that the effects of when you enter the labor force tend to be kind of long-lived and reverberate throughout your life. I would encourage students to make sure they get good employment and wait for that good job offer. But the bad news is that it tends to be the case. I know it's at the PhD level in academic on the job market, that if you enter the job market in a bad year, in a rough year, a rough couple of years, it tends to be that your opportunities and salaries and all that down the road tend to be affected. So that's we'll see what things are like in May for Brooke and others, but that's perhaps not good news. On the other hand, this is perhaps a great time for students to think about maybe going on to graduate school, depending on whether or not they have job opportunities. Mm-hmm. So you also see that. When the job market isn't doing that well for new graduates, that's when people tend to go to graduate school.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And not only graduate school, but also college.
All right.
You know, strong, maybe not on the finances side of the CSU system, but on the demand for college enrollment, it's also very strong because people find that, well, basically you can't get that job hanging drywall at $20 an hour now. And that maybe starts pushing you more looking towards a long-term option instead of concentrating on the immediate, what's my labor market potential here, and take the long-term. I think that, in addition to an actual formal recession, we want to think about the potential of what was at one time called a growth recession, where the economy basically sort of slows down to 0 or 1% growth. It's not actually shrinking, but there's not enough jobs generated to basically find employment for all the people who enter the labor force each year, or per capita income isn't keeping up because the population is continuing to grow. So I think that's a strong possibility as well.
Excellent. Arthur?
Well, concerning the formal part of the recession, I don't think we've had two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. I think last quarter was positive growth, and it's expected that this quarter may be negative. Mm-hmm. But so I don't think we're in a recession yet.
Mm-hmm. And why do you say that? That's quite interesting.
Yeah. The other thing I was wondering, with the doom and gloom outcast of our coming recession in the job market, is there any way I can avoid that? Can I just hide in a cave for a year or two until the recession goes away? Okay.
Graduate school is hiding in the cave.
Okay.
I don't want to place too much emphasis on that you have to go along on with your life, but I'm not certain how strategically you can avoid that, but graduate school is an option to if the labor market turns down. But I will also say I am, for the most part, not worried at all about our graduates and where they're going. It is a bright outlook for them, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. unless we're talking about, which some people are bringing up a hint of a major, very major mm-hmm. recession, unless it gets really, really bad, mm-hmm. I feel good about the long-term prospects of our Humboldt State students and other people entering the labor force. So it's not... It's not all doom and gloom, Arthur, with your prospects. You feel good about that.
And then I'd like to ask from any of you, what do you feel would be the best sector at this point to try to enter, say, for a student wants to do an internship or they want to try to target a particular area? Any of you, from anyone?
I think you're going to see certain sectors of the economy. You look towards something like healthcare, long-run growth potential of healthcare in terms of aging population, not a recession-sensitive industry at all, so that's going to continue to be a very strong long-run growth industry. And, you know, IT-related jobs, although they are somewhat cyclical because they respond to firms' capital spending, long-term trends there are still very, very positive. So although many of the Humboldt State graduates may not be exactly in IT fields, of course, there are often many management positions mm-hmm. and other mm-hmm. positions that are not dealing directly with the technology mm-hmm. that are very strong, likewise with healthcare, mm-hmm. you know, marketing or management or the insurance administration, that sort of thing, that's still very strong.
There's a big industry effect on wages, and so if you, to the degree that you can get involved with a growth industry mm-hmm. as opposed to a declining industry, mm-hmm. Healthcare that Michael mentioned has a good outlook for the future. Mm-hmm. So as a new graduate entering the labor force, mm-hmm. be aware of the some of the issues with the recession, but you still want to look ahead to long-term growth. So those industries that are growing, mm-hmm. In the short run, there are going to be some issues with sectors associated with housing and mm-hmm. maybe even finance, shakeouts in Wall Street and mm-hmm. Things associated with finance, banking perhaps, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. go with a long-term outlook. And everybody here on this stage, I feel very good about their outlook.
Well, I'd like to let our audience know that is part of what we're trained as economics at the Humboldt State, is how to forecast and how to make predictions. So this is also grist for the mill. All right, we'll move on now to our second question, and I'll start at the end here with Mr. Arthur Osorio. The second one is, the stimulus package has recently been signed into law. Rebates of $300 to $1,200 will be offered to taxpayers. Do you, in any of your opinions, starting with Arthur, do you feel that these rebates will have a real impact on the economy?
I have some funny feelings about the rebates. I kind of don't see them the way everybody else sees them. Mm-hmm. To me, you know, it reminds me of the helicopter Ben sort of thing, you know, raining money down on people. And it almost, to me, seems more like a move to inflation, you know, forcing inflationary forces more than like a fiscal stimulus package. And I don't know if this is to help the mortgages that are people having trouble paying their mortgages, and people are in the upside down mortgages. I happen to know some people myself that are in one. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it has any long-term effects, though, as most fiscal injections don't have long-term effects.
Michael, do you want to chime in on this?
I think the way in which I'd look at it would be something like an insurance policy. From what I read, the people who do this full-time, they do macroeconomic short-run business cycle mm-hmm. forecasting full-time, put the odds of a recession at something like 40-45%. You tack on to that a significant slowdown on top of that, and you get something like a 70-80% chance that mm-hmm. something bad is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Within that 40%, there's maybe, you know, a good chunk that it really is going to turn out to be something severe, that all the sort of sky is falling people actually are right this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe there's a 10-20% chance this is a good idea. Mm-hmm. So we're engaging something that hopefully this is a really bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we don't need it. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it's going to be a waste. Mm-hmm. But if it does turn out to be necessary, I think we will have been very glad we did it.
Okay.
So it's kind of like insurance.
Okay.
Well, I actually brought a prop. And so 2 days ago in my mailbox was this message from the IRS. And in big red bold letters it says, Enclosed is an important message from the IRS on the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008. Do not throw away. So let's see what this says. Actually, Brooke, you said you received one.
What? Yes, I read it yesterday.
And am I expecting good news here? Is this a check in here?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. Let's see what this says. Oh, no, I won't reveal any sensitive information out there just to protect myself.
Take out your security number.
Identity theft. Okay. Well, something on the back says how to determine your stimulus payment. And if your qualifying income is at least $3,000, then under $3,000, more than zero. It's got some rules here. Okay, so it doesn't have any sensitive information, it looks like. It says, dear taxpayer, we are pleased to inform you that the United States Congress passed and President George W. Bush signed into law the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008, which provides for economic stimulus payments to be made to over 130 million American households. Under this new law, you may be entitled to a payment of up to $600 or $1,200 filing a joint return, et cetera. So there's no personal information. They don't know whether I'm filing a joint return or not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is kind of interesting by sending this out because the stimulus package, it's really, in the details, supposed to be a tax, a prepaid rebate or an early rebate, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's a credit for your tax bill, that your 2008 tax bill, which you won't really be filing until April of 2009.
Hmm.
So I think this is scheduled to come in May or June. Mm-hmm. So why would I get this now as opposed, you know, I just wait for the check?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's some evidence that people can perhaps change their, will perhaps spend, change their spending patterns in anticipation of this.
I see.
And so that's what this is, I believe, all about, to to get people thinking about this, that they can start spending this this money now.
Okay.
Yeah, I just with the spending habits changing, do you really think it's going to change any spending habits? I mean, are people hoarding money in the bank right now? I mean, we don't have a positive savings rate. What changes are going to happen today before they have the money?
Well, they can maybe purchase things on credit card and expect to get this money to pay off their a little credit card debt, at least, some people.
You know, put things on credit card now might make things worse, though.
Right.
Well, if the two of you, Brooke and Arthur, received, let's say, $600 in May, what would you do with it?
Well, I need to pay my car registration, car insurance around that time, so that'll probably go to that.
But if you did use the money for that, then the money that you would have used to pay for the car registration
would probably put me in debt.
Okay, so you would at least not be incurring, you'd be avoiding
debt.
Right,
avoiding debt,
right.
How about you, Arthur? Any new,
you
new
know,
spending
it,
as a result?
It would probably not result in new spending. It would be saving, for sure. I don't have any big purchases coming. I'm not putting a down payment on a car or anything. I would think it would help in the transition to grad school, maybe, or getting a job. It'd put less pressure on me, maybe.
So what I'm gathering from what your thoughts are, that you all don't feel that a person should just basically rush out and start spending with this money. You might want to plan what you may want to use it for and use it kind of as a little bit of a safety net between what you know that you already have and what you anticipate in the short run you may be able to use this for. But don't go out and do a big ticket and think this is going to cover.
Right.
Is that correct?
Well,
invest and save.
Okay.
If people go ahead and do that, then it's less effective as a stimulus. So, you know,
yeah.
Which is why.
And there was a lot of discussion about this beforehand of policymakers wondering who should this check go to, and it was kind of interesting. We had a discussion about this one evening. You can target this to certain groups. Mm-hmm. And so they tried very, very hard to avoid certain groups. So not everybody get this. First of all, you have to file taxes.
Okay.
So, you know, an example, perhaps a person that doesn't file income taxes, maybe a homeless man on the street, won't be seeing $600, whereas that would probably be new spending right there. Then they realize, well, elderly who don't have income aren't going to get this. So the AARP...
Are those on entitlements?
Yeah, so we'll consider Social Security income now. So I don't know how that detail is going to work out. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to give money to higher income folks, mm-hmm. so it phases
out. Certain brackets.
Yeah, at some point. Mm-hmm. So they just tried very hard to mm-hmm. avoid some groups and then mm-hmm. give it to other groups. Classic mm-hmm. Sort of horse trading with the, you know.
Well, I'd like to have been on the fly on the wall when they decided that. Okay, folks, any other comments on this particular topic? We're going to go ahead and move now to question number 3, and that one is, how does the stimulus package affect the national debt and or deficit? And I'm going to start with you, Brooke, on that.
I'm not really sure if it will help the national deficit. Probably most likely $150 billion that's going to this stimulus package mm-hmm. will probably put us deeper in debt and mm-hmm. deficit and probably hurt us mm-hmm. more.
Mm-hmm.
And it might encourage people to buy cheap imported goods, so it might help stimulate China's economy rather than our own.
Hmm. Interesting. Arthur, your take on that.
Well, the China thing, that's even worse. That worsens our trade gap there.
Right.
But, without a doubt, it's going to incur debt to the nation. But we're a debtor nation, so maybe that's what we do best. I don't know what to say, really.
Michael.
I think I'd say, the majority of it probably will be spent on domestically produced goods, because mm-hmm. most goods mm-hmm. are... actually services, mm-hmm. and most services are non-traded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be the lion's share. So I would guess probably of the amount that's spent rather than saved,
mm-hmm.
probably something like 75, 80 cents mm-hmm. on the dollar gets spent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you're spending $160, $150 billion mm-hmm. to generate how much consumer spending. Is that a good trade-off? I think that's a lot less clear,
mm-hmm.
unless, of course,
mm-hmm.
This is the worst case scenario, in which mm-hmm. case, again, we'll be glad to. I guess for me, that's it all comes down to
mm-hmm.
are the worst case scenarios likely enough
mm-hmm.
That this is a good idea? So it's essentially, for me, if we just end up having a mild recession or if we just have sort of this growth slowdown for a year
mm-hmm.
or two,
mm-hmm.
I think this will regret this. Mm-hmm. But if we do turn out to have some really severe scenario, then we will be very glad, and
mm-hmm.
I think we'll see another such package
mm-hmm.
6 or 12 months after this one.
Okay. Eric, any thoughts?
It's kind of amazing how quickly this was passed with support from Democrats and Republicans, and without the data in your face that says we are in a recession. GDP growth has not been negative yet.
Mm-hmm.
The unemployment rate has gone up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But when this was seriously being discussed
mm-hmm.
In January, and then I believe it passed in February, but
mm-hmm.
January mm-hmm. when it was seriously discussed, it wasn't at all clear. It's a little more clear now that things are slowing down. We're getting much
mm-hmm.
more news about that.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that strikes me as, wow, they're really trying to tackle something very early.
Yeah, mm-hmm. what did they know that we didn't know? I guess is the question.
But what do you mean by that?
How did they decide so easily to pass this? Well, I mean, is there some other force involved? Is it political? Is it? I mean, if the numbers weren't there, it seems pretty risky to do that. Anyway, were there any leading indicators?
Yeah, I think that's a key question. Were there leading indicators? We do know that this is an election year, but the question would be, these are our lawmakers, so what tools do they have in their arsenal to make these decisions? And as economists, that's what we're trained to look at, is the tools in the arsenal rather than the finger to the wind. And I think that's the reason we're having this panel discussion, to kind of get an educated, erudite look at this rather than sort of your gut reaction. Okay, excellent. Any more thoughts on this topic before we move on to question number 4?
I think the only thing I would add to all this mm-hmm. is, back in December, we did have the Federal Reserve cut, 1.25% off of its rates in
mm-hmm.
8 days,
mm-hmm.
which is virtually unprecedented. And that mm-hmm. is just, not to be hyperbolic, but that's essentially panic.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
about as close as you're going to see the Federal Reserve get to panic.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that happening in December, and politicians seeing that the Fed is taking this so incredibly seriously and reacting so strongly might have lit a fire under people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, nobody wants to be the obstructionist mm-hmm. if the other guy wants to hand out free money in an election
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
If I could just continue with that about, you know, we've gotten data since then.
Mm-hmm.
There was an economic summit last week at Stanford University. A lot of very bright economists were there. And this was the topic. What's happening? Are we recession? What's going on? And a person who was the former economist at Harvard, the former president at Harvard, and also the worked in the Treasury Department under President Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
He's one thing he said really struck me. He said that we're potentially facing the biggest. I'm paraphrasing here, but financial problems in a generation and perhaps longer.
Mm-hmm.
And to me that conveys the idea of this could be on the finance side mm-hmm. very, very serious. So when Arthur asks what do they know mm-hmm. or that, you know, why are they reacting mm-hmm. so quickly, I think on the finance side as opposed to the real economy, but mm-hmm. people lending to one another, I think that is really stopped moving mm-hmm. to such a degree that a lot of very smart people are really saying there is a chance that mm-hmm. something really bad can happen, and not to say it's over 50-50, but there, you know, a chance is as great as we've seen in a long, long mm-hmm. time of a major, some people might say meltdown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a good point in our program to ask any of you on the panel where the public may go to get some more information on this particular question, a website or something that you could suggest that's digestible for the general public, or journal, newspaper. What do you suggest?
For the general public?
For the public that may be interested in this particular question.
In the particular issue of what's going on in the financial sector.
Yes.
And
what do they know that we don't know? So they come abreast of it.
I think the Wall Street Journal's great. I mean, in the articles that the Wall Street Journal writes, sometimes they'll bring in fundamentals and explain things to you, even if you do know them, it's a nice reminder, but I think they do a really good job of being accessible to the general public. It just has kind of a scary name.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the New York Times also has featured some guest editorials and some articles by Professor Schiller, who's written some good stuff. One of their reporters, David Leonhardt, has also done some good research on this. And so it's being reported, and you go back as early as, you know, summer, and people were starting to murmur about, oh, gee, there might be something happening. Mm-hmm. So this has fortunately been a long, slow, you know, wave coming at us. It has not come as a
mm-hmm.
sudden, you know, hit by an iceberg. It's a sort of slow flood with the water slowly rising. So fortunately, there has been a lot of time for people,
mm-hmm.
both, you know, full-time, 100% economic people like the Federal Reserve
mm-hmm.
and the political sector
mm-hmm.
to react to it. Of course, it would have been a lot better mm-hmm. if they had reacted to it before it became a problem, but the fact
mm-hmm.
that it has unfolded slowly
mm-hmm.
is in many ways a good thing, that has allowed a policy response to be shaped with a little bit more thought than it might otherwise be.
You know, the slow unfolding is something that Dr. Eschker, I think, pointed out early in some of his research with the housing market. He'd said that when the housing market crashes, it's going to come slowly, and it's not going to be, you know, overnight, everyone's on the street or anything. It's going to happen over a long period of time, and it's going to happen very slowly, and that's kind of how it looks now with the economy.
But the number of houses is going to stay the same, so not everybody.
Yeah,
different people in the apartments and different people in the houses, right?
That's true, yeah.
It's not the houses.
I'm going to be in an apartment a little while longer.
Right.
So.
Well, no, because the house is going to the price of the houses is going to decline, so presumably you have a better chance of getting
What if
house?
The rents go up on the apartments, though? I'm
You're definitely operating in glass half empty.
If I could just interject here, if you were just joining us right now, this a witty repartee is our capstone class for the Economics 490 course. This is a senior project, and we're joined with four panel members who are all part of the economics department, and we're talking about the economics of a recession and what it means to you. Okay. All right, great. Let's go ahead now, if we can. I'd like to move to question number four. And that question is, and I'm going to start with you, Eric, how does a recession affect the housing market? 2 points on here, financing and foreclosures. I think it's a great segue. We're just on that.
I'm going to change the question, and how does the housing market affect a recession? And because that's really what's at the heart of what's happening. And maybe even step back a bit more. What people are pointing to is a finance problem. And financing is simply, you know, credit makes the world go around. So if I can't get financing, if somebody won't extend me a loan for something, whether it's a student at HSU to go here, or the big news is businesses and banks and companies trying to get their business done, they need to borrow in the short run. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is there isn't a lot of that lending happening right now. And the real thing that's the cause for that is in housing, the housing prices are coming down so much. Mm-hmm. And importantly, there's so much uncertainty about where they're going to go that basically in financial sectors, nobody trusts what the borrowers have to put up as collateral. Mm-hmm. And so you hear people talking about things like mortgage-backed securities. Mm-hmm. That means I want to borrow some money, and I have the right to collect the mortgage on this pooled group of houses, mortgage-backed securities, and people just have no faith that those are worth very much at all. Mm-hmm. And that because of what many economists see as a bubble in housing, that a run up in prices far above fundamentals, and now a return to that. Mm-hmm. That's really what is driving this.
Mm-hmm. Michael, if you'd like to chime in, you were just on it.
Brooke seems like she's escaping a lot of the.
I'm sorry. I'm just following.
Go ahead. I like Eric Eschker as a professor, and he knows a lot about foreclosures and the housing market, and I agree with everything he's said.
I'm sorry.
If I could just point the question to you in this regard. You're going to be leaving college very shortly.
Yeah.
Part of the American dream is that home ownership.
Yeah.
In light of the current landscape, financial landscape, how would you feel about home ownership at this point? Are you going to stay out or stay in your apartment?
Yeah, not right now owning a home, but it looks like prices of houses are going down a lot, and maybe in the near future it'll be a good buyer's market.
Okay.
So save up a little bit of money first, and then maybe jump in to that.
It's actually perfect to ask people like Brooke and Arthur about this, that in the last decade or half decade or so, because credit was so easy for people buying a house, you had fairly young people fresh out of college buying houses, whereas 20 years ago it was typically a little bit later. And the question is, do you see this as a good time to buy? And the question is always, well, how low are they going to go?
Right.
You know, that's a question. I don't know what Arthur what he thinks about that.
Well, I think I have a hard time generalizing that. I think there's places in this country that are still, you know, houses that are affordable to live in, and if you're willing to move, then you can reap those benefits, and that's the market at work, and I think people can take advantage of that still. I think there's still room for efficient allocation of people across this country.
Does this question I would have Brooke and Arthur. Would you make decisions on where to work and where to live based on housing prices?
Not right now, but maybe in the future when I am looking to buy a house. Yeah. Right now, just want to move back home and see family who have been away from for a while. So, live in Southern California for a little while, even though the housing market down there is probably the worst place to be. But yeah, in the future, when I'm thinking about buying a house, I'll definitely think about different locations.
I think I'd look at that from the other side. I'd look at it for the income opportunities more than the housing, but it's certainly factored in. But it's I think it's easier for me to see the opportunities, the job opportunities and the income opportunities of certain areas over others than the housing prices.
Right.
Something that I could give up a room to, you know, give $100,000 up for. It's kind of easy to fit in where you need to fit in when you have the income that you want.
Well, looking long term, and I pose this to you, Eric, do you feel that home ownership makes you more viable in terms of your economic health?
Well, there have been papers that have come out recently that have actually argued that owning a home is harmful to your economic health. And when I think of economic health, I mean your job prospects and maybe even for a community. The story that people talk about today is in areas of the Midwest, let's say Detroit, mm-hmm. With chronic declines in the auto industry. The one problem is that the housing doesn't disappear every 5 years. It sticks around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, people, as the price falls there,
mm-hmm.
people are, and but it lasts, so the mm-hmm. housing stock is still around. People aren't encouraged as much to leave. And I've also read works where they say where you have a higher portion of people renting
mm-hmm.
Tend to be more vibrant areas. There's a causality problem, too, because those are going to attract people that are a little more transitory because mm-hmm. they'll come in for opportunities and then leave. But
mm-hmm. yeah. Okay. Michael, anything on that?
You know, I think I would definitely agree that there is inconclusive, but there's definitely some evidence mm-hmm. that because owning property makes mm-hmm. you less willing to move,
mm-hmm.
it can contribute to labor markets not adjusting quickly, people not moving to where there are growing industries, instead they stick in areas where there are declining industries.
Mm-hmm.
I teach some personal finance, mm-hmm. and the thing I would say is that you look at the rate of return you get by buying
mm-hmm.
a house.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on, you know, which paper you read, it looks like about 0.5% to 1.5% above inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a great investment.
Okay.
But where I would say that if there's a truth to housing being a key to building wealth is that when you agree to a mortgage, you're trading a small monthly payment with your rent for a large payment with your mortgage. At first, almost all of that is interest. Only a little bit's principal. So the principal, though, is a kind of saving. So what you're saying here is, I want to take my monthly payment from $1,500 a month to $2,500 a month. And of that, maybe $200 or $300 is going to be principal. But, you know, 10, 20 years out, it's almost all principal. So what you've really done here is you've tied your hands. You've locked yourself in to paying off all this principal, which is a form of saving. So I think even though it really does not have a good rate of return,
mm-hmm.
because it forces you, it pre-commits you into this savings plan,
mm-hmm.
that's why it's a good way to build wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it's a good investment,
mm-hmm.
but because the fundamental problem for most people isn't making good investments,
mm-hmm.
it's saving at all.
Mm-hmm.
Their lack of discipline.
It's
when it comes
lack
to
of
saving.
Discipline, right?
So, instead, if you took the equivalent of that mortgage and put it in a 401k or the retirement funds, you might come out ahead. But people are
right. But yeah. So yeah. If that would happen, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, again, I'd like to take the opportunity. Do you have any suggestions that the general public can go to for some kind of background on this? Issue of foreclosures is large in the news right now, and there's a lot of crosstalk going on. Can you all think of any reliable sources that would give some information for our general public on this?
A very high level, you know, not easily digestible, but potentially mm-hmm. by educated lay people, source is there's actually a very excellent blog, and you know, blogs are very mixed bag, called Calculated Risk.
That's a great one,
and
yeah.
It is, you know. It's been, I think someone referenced it when they went before Congress a couple weeks ago.
Perfect.
So, you know, if something rises to that level, I think we can, as academics,
okay.
recommend it as well.
I would also add a little push for the economics department. We have a website, Housing Real Estate Economics for locally, for Humboldt County. So we post data on foreclosures, home prices over time, and if anybody's interested in the data, they can get that from me. But we've got a lot of neat resources there, and the address is www.humboldt.edu/indexhum. Indexhum, and just click on the real estate section. So if you're interested in local data, that's a good site. I get data from a lot of different places, and we post it there. And it has a link to calculated risk as well.
Thank you. Either the two students here, Brooke or Arthur, do you have any favorite sites you'd like to go to on this?
I don't really follow the housing market at all, but sure. I hear people praising calculated risk as well.
Mm-hmm. So. And I do know that Eric's index is very good as well.
Excellent. All right. Any other comments on this question? We ready to move on? Okay. Very good. All right. I'd like to now move to our fifth question, and that one is, How does a recession affect the consumer credit? It's a two-part question, availability of credit and credit worthiness. And I'm going to open it up for Arthur.
The availability of credit, now that should be an easy one. It's going to be less credit available. That's why the Fed is lowering those rates and trying to lower the Fed funds rate. And I don't know how much lower it can go, but I worry that they're going to have to stop at some point and start going back up, and then I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know.
Okay. Brooke, do you want to?
Well, Eric always says credit makes the world go round, so we need credit, and more credit, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you say about credit worthiness, though?
People's worthiness, mm-hmm, of credit. Oh gosh. Well, I do know that the more in debt you are, the, mm-hmm, more credit they like to give you. So, mm-hmm, that's not such a good thing. Mm-hmm. And those more worthy probably shouldn't, mm-hmm, be those receiving more, mm-hmm, credit.
Okay. But, maybe an interesting question to Brooke and Arthur is, not yourselves, but friends or acquaintances that you know, is how important is the access to credit, meaning student loans or credit cards, things like that?
Well, personally, I've managed to stay off credit, I think entirely. But thanks to help from my family, though. I couldn't have paid for school myself, and working through school is really tough. But people around me have needed credit, student loans for sure. But credit cards, people say they need them for emergencies, but I haven't really seen it, you know. Don't see that for emergencies very often. I don't think people need credit cards.
Well, it's really hard to not have to take out school loans. I'm envious of you in that respect, because I have school loans myself, and I'm sure most college students, mm-hmm, are indebted because of their schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I'd like to just sort of throw in on my end, I could not afford school without scholarships, and I'm getting my AmeriCorps Education Award this year, and that's helping out with only half of my tuition, so I have to scramble to find internships and do the part-time job and what have you. So I'm a person that needs to take out loans, needs, mm-hmm, to find that supplemental. There are five kids in my family, so my folks can't quite afford to foot the bill for me, but on the flip side, being an economics major with a biometry minor, it helps me make a recipe for what I'm going to need so I can check out those ingredients. How much money do I actually need? What budget should I actually get? How far in my short run, say 6 months, what do I need to put in to be able to pay that bill? And I think it helps students get a little more realistic about what they may want to do with that bachelor's degree. Yes, it's a little tough, but on the other hand, it helps you work mentally on what you need to do. So, yes, these are tough times, so this is why, again, education is very helpful. It helps you get a strategy going, and it's great to be a part of a family like our Humboldt family, because there's always someone that knows about it that can help you out. Okay, any more thoughts on this particular question?
I just wanted to say something about the Federal Reserve, since we're talking about credit, and you read the newspaper, what the Federal Reserve is doing, and so far it's been acting kind of traditional, and at the same time doing things very, very different than it has in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's been lowering interest rates. We've talked about that. And the idea with lowering interest rates is it's supposed to make credit more available, mm-hmm, to households and firms and financial institutions. But there's a lot of evidence that that isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
The mortgage rates, for instance, aren't coming down all that much. The the rates that banks are lending to one another, the spread between that and the treasury rates mm-hmm. are still high. So there's some evidence that isn't happening. The fact that as the Federal Reserve deals with banks and gives them funds to loan out, they're not responding by issuing loans. I think, again, that there's a lot of uncertainty and distrust as far as what the collaterals that firms mm-hmm. have for loans. What the Fed is doing differently now mm-hmm. is instead of traditional monetary policy where it says we're going to buy a treasury bond, which is a fairly safe asset, very, very safe asset, mm-hmm. we're going to buy that mm-hmm. and infuse reserves into the banks, their balance sheets. Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve now is actually taking on some of this debt that is mm-hmm. That is much more risky, like the mortgage-backed mm-hmm. securities, mm-hmm. and it's I'm kind of concerned about that. But on the other hand, I think the Fed must be very, very concerned to be trying something so new and bold.
Have they begun that? I didn't know they started doing that.
They announced it seems like every month or so they have a new program, but they've just announced recently that they are going to accept different types of collateral, so on loans that they're making to banks and institutions.
Excellent. Well, I think this is a good opportunity to just ask anyone on the panel, what is the Fed? We hear about the Fed.
Great
what
question.
What is it? I'd like to know.
That sounds
anyone
like a great great question for any of these students who's passed that intermediate macroeconomics.
Or money in banking. Yeah.
Or money
right.
in banking.
Brooke, you want to chime in?
The Federal Reserve System controls the interest rate, of course, and raises it and lowers it with respect to what's going on in the economy. Mm. They make loans to banks who are going under, different things of that sort.
We've got a very smart guy at the helm of the Fed. Matter of fact, he's the author of this textbook here, this macroeconomics, intermediate macroeconomics textbook. We don't use it, though, here at Humboldt. But that's okay.
But it's there for our awareness.
It's there for everybody.
Arthur, you want to chime in?
Sure. Well, the Federal Reserve is in charge of our monetary policy. It controls the money supply. Yeah. It targets Fed fund rates, can't control them, but you know, it can try to influence interest rates up and down. She mentioned that it's a lender of last resort for some banks. Saved us before, I guess, in a couple other credit crises. I'm not sure. Eric mentioned the buying of the bonds and securities. That's what the Fed does. It influences the money supply. That's the main thing the Federal Reserve does.
Yeah, that is its secret power, its special power. It
yeah.
gets to print all the money.
Yeah.
And it gets to decide how much money is in mm-hmm. circulation
mm-hmm.
or not.
Mm-hmm.
And basically by increasing the rate of money growth relative to the growth rate of the economy mm-hmm. can cause both the economy to grow faster and inflation to go up. So it always faces this trade-off between, on the one hand, it can stimulate the economy,
mm-hmm.
making unemployment go down, making GDP growth go up, at least in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it makes inflation worse.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can, you know, restrain the growth of the money supply, in which case inflation starts to become less.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you may risk going into recession.
Mm-hmm.
My personal assessment is Ben Bernanke, very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Bernanke, student of the Great Depression, mm-hmm. student of the large bad debt-driven deflation crisis that mm-hmm. Japan endured throughout the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
both his academic research and everything he said, I think, focuses on him wanting to avoid those worst-case scenarios that he has studied so much.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he does this full-time. I know that he has a staff of people who are much smarter, much harder working, than I am, who are 100% specialized in studying these problems. It may be naive, but I'm inclined to think that they know things that I don't, and that they would not recklessly cut interest rates
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
increase inflation unless there was really some severe risk of something really bad happening. You know, I think if they pull off what they're trying to pull off,
mm-hmm.
what we'll have is basically unemployment will go up about 0 or 2%. Mm-hmm. Inflation will go up about 0 or 2%, but we will avoid that worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. So I think they're basically, they're taking a little bit of a gamble. They go, okay, let's shoot for some medium bad outcome, mm-hmm, in the hopes of avoiding the absolute worst case outcome.
Okay. They could make it even worse than your worst case outcome, though, with stagflation, though. I mean, if the policies don't do what they want them to do, there's going to be inflation and there's going to be no growth, and then where are we?
I think the
1970s.
Yeah, we're in the 1970s.
I'll take U.S. in the 1970s over Japan in the 1990s.
Well, I have two other things just to clarify for our audience. Can you define GDP, and then you're saying that the Fed sets monetary policy. Are they independent of who's in the White House in terms of political party, or are they independent?
They're supposed to be independent. So, yeah.
Well, from what I've seen, if you look at central banks around the world, the Fed is fairly independent. But that's not to say that's not to say at all that they're not concerned about being reappointed, because Ben Bernanke would have to is reappointed periodically, or regularly he's reappointed. Yeah.
And he is the chair of the Fed.
Right. He's okay. The guy at the helm.
Okay.
My analogy would be sort of it's the Supreme Court of money and stabilizing the economy. You have these members of the Board of Governors that are appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. They serve these very long 14-year terms. So, you know, practically speaking, you know, if you're nominated by one guy 14 years later, you might be up for confirmation. It's going to be an entirely different Congress and President by the time you come up for confirmation. So much in the same way that the Supreme Court does, there's a combination of indirect political control and insulation from popular pressure, and that's a very mixed bag. On the one hand, it can make them potentially callous and removed from the concerns of everyday people. On the other hand, it's not clear that you would want the Federal Reserve cranking up the money supply every time the polls indicated that people wanted, mm-hmm, that to happen. So I think it's a tricky, tricky trade-off.
The more independence the Federal Reserve has, if you look around the globe, or a central bank in an economy, you tend to find there be less inflation. Economists are okay generally with a steady, low degree of inflation. It's when inflation starts creeping up, because it's so hard to bring it back down. And I think right now that's what we're seeing, that the Fed is probably saying we're a little bit less concerned about inflation. Because the Fed has, by law, it's supposed to keep prices stable, mm-hmm, and keep labor markets functioning and low unemployment rates. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are hard to do at the same time, mm-hmm, and it seems like right now the Fed is, well, it's doing things like lowering the interest rate, mm-hmm, that will directly lead to higher prices.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation expectations are going up.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed is really lowering interest rates, and you know what's happened recently is there have been some indications of the expected inflation rate. If you look at the inflation rate as compared to, they have inflation protected securities,
mm-hmm,
that the Treasury Department offers, that what you can get as far as an expected inflation rate is very low, if not negative, out there right now. So the Federal Reserve really is in many ways has the pedal to the metal.
Okay. And GDP, what is that?
Oh, gross domestic product. That's the sum of all goods and services produced in our nation.
Excellent. Any more comments on this particular question? I just have something I always wanted to know. Is there really money in Fort Knox, or is this just is that just something that's cultural?
I think it's just gold, not money.
It's gold.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not as much as it used to be, though. That used to be when we were on the gold standard. That was the gold that backed all of our dollars.
Oh. So we're no longer on the gold standard?
No.
When did that end?
That ended effectively for you and I being able to swap dollar bills for gold during the Depression.
Yeah.
And then the last, between central banks in the early 1970s. So,
mm-hmm,
we've been off the gold standard for a long time. Mm-hmm. So the Fed really is what's trying to preserve the value of the dollar,
mm-hmm,
to ensure that it doesn't take every year a whole lot more dollars,
mm-hmm,
to buy the same amount of goods and services. Mm-hmm. I will say one thing about inflation, that a good thing of inflation, and Brooke and Arthur in the intermediate macro class, we talked a little bit about this. We talked about it in the sense, in the context of labor markets. Inflation is good because it kind of it primes the pump, it greases the gears, keeps things going. Mm-hmm. And specifically now with housing, mm-hmm. I said before that's really the root of what's happening here. Mm-hmm. Most projections and futures for Case-Shiller Index are that housing prices are predicted to come down substantially, double digits across the country, and especially where most of the people live. Mm-hmm. There's two ways you can have housing prices come down in real terms. Mm-hmm. You can either have the price of the house fall, mm-hmm. let's say 20%, mm-hmm. or you could have the price of the house stay the same in dollars, mm-hmm. but everything else, the prices go up by 20%, mm-hmm. and inflation can erode away the price, mm-hmm. the relative price, or the real price of housing.
Okay.
And I think that's I think that's has been considered and maybe part of the plan here, mm-hmm. to engineer some inflation, mm-hmm. To because what people owe on mortgages, mm-hmm. and we haven't talked a whole lot about foreclosures, mm-hmm. and mortgages, that's fixed in dollar terms, in mm-hmm. nominal terms.
Mm-hmm.
So if you owe a certain amount, mm-hmm. if there's a whole lot of inflation, that doesn't matter. You still owe the same amount. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can restore a bank to solvency even if its customers owe more on their mortgages than the property's worth. Well, create a lot of inflation, property's now worth more, problem solved.
Mm.
It's a very, very big, blunt tool, mm. but among the limited tools that the Federal Reserve has, that is one of them.
And housing is a big, blunt part of the economy.
And housing is a big, blunt, hard to move. And
well, so it's part of our idea, the American dream, is the home ownership. So that, I think, is very important for our audience and our students who will be entering the work world to consider. Okay, excellent. I think this has been a lot of fun, folks. We have two more questions, and the next one is going to be on the stock market, which is the one that I'm really interested in. I'm just going to ask, and I think I want to start with Michael on this. What is responsible, in your opinion, for the volatility and or decline of the stock market?
People have a vast amount of uncertainty over what's happening in the economy. You know, we just the discussion here in this panel, I think, indicates an incredible level of uncertainty, an incredible difference of opinion. There's a lot of mixed evidence. You know, are we, you know, overstimulating the economy? We're mostly going to get up a lot of inflation. Are, you know, we're going to head towards some sort of normal recession? Is there going to be some sort of nightmare scenario? Nobody knows. And I think that's essentially
so the stock market's not where to be. That's not... Yeah, it's not the safe place to be right now.
You know, J.P. Morgan was once asked, you know, what's the stock market going to do? And he said, it'll fluctuate.
Yeah, it's a random walk.
I won't claim that I know.
Yeah.
I'll claim that probably in the long run, if you can sit it out, probably the stock market is the place to be, but that's if you want to stick it out for 30 years. Mm-hmm. 5 years? No.
That's the mm-hmm. traditional,
that's
like 10% over the long run sort of game.
So your retirement for you is easy. Just put in the stock market and you'll wait your 30 years.
And don't watch it in the short run because you'll give yourself an ulcer. And you'll pull out. And ignoring it in some sense is, I think, the way to go.
I should say the stock market is... The stock market can provide some information. You might think that the stock market fundamentals, if the stock market is falling, that would indicate that the market believes that firms will be less profitable, at least, and particularly in the near future, mm-hmm. that might indicate recession. Mm-hmm. There are also other, some other people think the stock markets will go up and down with sort of irrationality, sort of a herd mentality, herd movements. Mm-hmm. But the stock market is not part of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It doesn't directly figure into, you know, the unemployment rate, mm-hmm. the inflation rate.
Mm-hmm.
But it could signal something. But it's not a direct measure of the things we might be interested in, like workers working, are people earning income, and what's happening to prices.
The proverb among economists is, the stock market has predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions. And that's basically it. And it's not actually predicted. It actually contemporaneously declines. So at exactly the same time, before the real government economic data is available, if you see a huge stock market decline, mm-hmm. there's a good chance there's going to be, or there is a recession currently mm-hmm. starting. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, four times out mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. nine, nothing mm-hmm. happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for our new, our students entering the world of work, if you were to invest in the stock market, what would you pick?
Oh gosh, well, we're seeing oil prices go up. Maybe oil's a good a good stock to buy into. Just anything that will that hold its value or you expect to grow in value.
So something that's low risk that you see
right.
that has a high growth potential.
Exactly.
Okay, safe better.
Safe.
Okay, Arthur.
Yeah, I personally have inflationary risk issues. Like, I'm afraid of inflation a lot. And so I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be in the stock market right now. Mm-hmm. I would, if I had to be, I guess, I'd have some trained professionals. I'd put it in a mutual fund that's mm-hmm, going to mm-hmm. give themselves an ulcer over my money so that I wouldn't have to worry about it.
Some people have said that the next bubble is in commodities. Mm-hmm. And so a story goes something like this. In the late 1990s, you had a dot-com bubble with mm-hmm. Tech stocks and in the stock market broadly that may have been bid up high. It was over 12,000 year 2000, and it took a number of years after that recession in the early 2000s where it took a number of years before mm-hmm. the stock market recovered.
Mm-hmm.
We then had, the story goes, a bubble in housing, mm-hmm. another asset where people mm-hmm. wanted to put mm-hmm. their funds. Mm-hmm. And perhaps now, Brooke mentioned oil. Mm-hmm. We may have a bubble perhaps in that. Mm-hmm. So oil is going up, but the question is always, what's it going to do tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Or what's it going to do the next year? And I think this is very, I'm not going to give advice on personal intent, but it's tough because inflation is starting to go up. And mm-hmm. What you had happening in Japan in the 90s was people were willing to accept negative returns for security, making sure they didn't encounter even larger returns and mm-hmm. maybe the larger negative returns in the mm-hmm. Japanese stock market or mm-hmm. housing or in companies, investing in companies mm-hmm. directly. So this is a strange time mm-hmm. as inflation creeps up.
And you say commodities. For our audience, what are commodities?
Commodities would be good old-fashioned things that we like to have, like oil. Mm-hmm. Gold is a commodity, so it's things that you can actually grab a hold of.
Tangible.
And tangible things.
Mm-hmm.
Pork bellies.
Things that come in barrels and that are ships and rails.
Okay.
Precious metals and.
Okay. Well, so you're saying don't put the money under the mattress, but don't expect the stock market to be a slot machine for quick return. Is that?
I would never advise anyone to invest in the stock market short term. I'd also advise people, don't spend your time trying to pick individual stocks. There are mounds and mounds and reams and endless supplies of evidence mm-hmm. that even professional money managers cannot beat the stock market mm-hmm. reliably.
Mm-hmm.
So probably not worth your while. The only other thing I'd add is the dollar behaving as it is and the U.S. economy behaving as it is, no one should overlook, if they're having a long time horizon for their investment, mm-hmm. potentially investing their money outside the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, yes, a declining dollar hurts you mm-hmm. because it means that as a consumer you pay more for your imports, but mm-hmm. at least your mm-hmm. investments will do well.
I can see a whole bunch of people having just thrown something at the television or
writing your name down
or at the computer screen, however they're watching this, saying, what do you mean we can't give credible advice? But I'm with Mike on that. And in our classes, we talk about something called the efficient market hypothesis. And I don't want to put the students on the spot, mm-hmm. but maybe you've heard of that at all. Or,
I think I may have heard of that.
Okay. So we tell our students about that it's, and the Wall Street Journal has even looked at it. It's really, being blindfolded and throwing a dart at the mm-hmm. stock pages and picking it that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you, as long as you measure it correctly, that's really what's going on. You just there's no, you know, unless you have insider information,
mm-hmm. that's valuable, isn't it?
But okay, I think that's exciting, and I'd like to ask Arthur again now that you all have raised this, and you did say 401k. With this information that's just been raised, if you were to look at diversifying your retirement, what would you invest in and where?
Wow, that's too much for me right now. I really haven't thought about diversifying for retirement. Maybe I'm caught empty. Maybe I should have been.
But if you were, say you had some money.
Sounds silly, but maybe gold.
Gold, yeah. Precious metals. Gold is, we've seen gold rise in value a lot over the last few years, and gold is probably a really good commodity to mm-hmm. invest in, mm-hmm. but diversifying mutual bonds, stocks, real estate, precious metals, just diversify is important.
Mm-hmm. And hold on to it.
Mm-hmm.
For retirement, right.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think about short run.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also say that, now I'm going to have something thrown at me, is that if you're talking about planning for retirement, fees are so important. And so I'm a big fan of just mutual funds that are indexed and passively managed that have low fees.
Mm-hmm.
That's because if something's gaining 3% a year, but the fees are 1.5%,
mm-hmm.
boy, you've just cut your return in half.
Mm-hmm.
You
okay.
throw taxes on it. So that's another thing. Watch the fees
okay.
that wherever you're going.
I very much agree that, you know, all the evidence points that highly paid, highly intelligent, highly educated mutual fund managers, because they're all competing with one another, can't beat the market.
Mm-hmm.
It's like nobody bats over 500
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
they're all competing with each other and they're all so good.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they can't bat over 500 doesn't mean that they're bad people and that
mm-hmm.
they're, you know, unskilled or uneducated. It means that markets are extremely competitive.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, why should I pay you a lot of money to manage my money if you can't beat the market? So, again, just reams of evidence that
mm-hmm.
most small investors are better off
mm-hmm.
just taking their money, put it in an index mutual fund that's
mm-hmm.
completely passive, fire and forget,
mm-hmm.
basically. Just because I can't resist trotting it out there, you
mm-hmm.
know. Even if you were incredibly intelligent, you're smarter than all those professional
mm-hmm.
money managers who went and got their MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you can, by working 1,500 hours a year on
mm-hmm.
your own private portfolio,
mm-hmm.
net an extra 3% above what they could get you.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you had $100,000 to invest.
Mm-hmm.
There's an extra $3,000 for 1,500 hours work.
Mm-hmm.
So you've just made yourself $2 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you have other more important things to do
mm-hmm.
than to micromanage your investment portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're that good, go off and get that job
mm-hmm.
managing other people's money
mm-hmm.
and earning, you know,
mm-hmm.
0.1% of the several $1 million you have under your management.
And I'd like to take this opportunity to let our audience know that also on the same floor as the Economics Department, we have the SBDC, which is a group that helps people who want to launch their own entrepreneurships or form some kind of a business, do something locally. These things are available on campus. What's the website for that?
Oh, goodness. I don't know the website offhand, but if they go to the university website and then look for the SBDC, Small Business Development Center, then they will find that. We also have, right next door to the Economics Department, the OECD, which is not the organization in Paris that tracks international developed countries' data, but it's the Office for Economic and Community Development, and that's a great resource for partnerships that the university has with folks on the outside, businesses and other community development folks, and other things are happening out of the university.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't mind asking what are Brooke and Arthur and you, Don? What are your plans when you graduate?
I think I've already said I'm planning on moving home. Hopefully, find a good job. Maybe a financial advisor, some investment firm or something, insurance, anything that'll pay me.
I think there'll be a lot of people that'll pay you.
also hope so.
I might be out there looking for that nice cozy cave, but I might start teaching. So
you've done a great job already. I'd take your class. You've been doing great. I'm interested in health and health economics. For my spring break, I'm actually going to be doing direct service learning in Managua, Nicaragua. I've just done my banquet. It was a benefit banquet, and because I've been taking Mike Dennis's class, I was very successful. I lowered my ticket price from $100 to $40, and we netted a lot more tickets. So I'm interested, actually, in working with the United Nations, hopefully the World Health Organization. I'm an intern with their USA branch, and so I'm trying to develop partnerships with non-governmental organizations that I can use as sponsors and show that I have a track record and hopefully go that route. I've been doing that basically since high school, kind of service learning, volunteering in the community. This will be my first opportunity to go abroad, and I've been working a year on this project with our service partner called Otteros, and we're actually going to go for debriefing this coming break, and then in May we'll actually work with a doctor brigade coming from University of Michigan and graduate students from University of Florida. So we will be coordinating their schedules, helping to get out supplies, and also doing some quality control on what they've already been doing in the community for 2 years. So it's real world stuff, what you learn in school. Once you get out there, you don't know what you know until you get out there and start doing it. So I'd like to segue now into our very last question, and that is, are there any international impacts on credit/finance market when there is a recession? Two parts here, value of the dollar, balance of trade. And I'm going to start with Eric on that one.
Well, it's no surprise that if the Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates, that has to lead to a lower dollar, especially since the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates more than the other central banks from the major countries around the world. So the dollar has gotten tremendously weaker over the last few years, and recently in particular. That's no surprise. I should also say it's no surprise that commodity prices are going up. If you think of the Federal Reserve and lowering interest rates, it's no surprise that it may take more dollars to buy that barrel of oil or that ounce of gold and all that. So but one thing that comes out of a weaker dollar, and I should say that I think it's fair to say generally economists often don't pay too much attention to and the international side because things let me rephrase that, to the trade deficit, unless it becomes very sizable or quick movements. I think that's something that grabs headlines a lot more. But the United States has a large trade deficit, and one outcome of having a weaker dollar is that the trade deficit has started to narrow a little bit, although in the short run, what it means is that our imports, which we import, oil is a big part of that, and from other countries like Japan, so that has kept the trade deficit from falling much more. But eventually, we'll be able to export a lot more with a weaker dollar, and we will cut back on imports, which there's evidence of that has happened already, because boy, those imported goods are much more expensive now,
and we have a lower income because we're in a recession.
And we're in a recession. Yeah.
The only thing I'd want to add to that is, surprisingly, as an academic, I would like to quibble a little bit with what Eric said at the very beginning. I think I'd say many economists do watch the trade deficit, but they watch it as a symptom rather than as a problem of itself. So we often think it's a symptom of very low amounts of national saving. We're using more stuff than we're producing. Well, if we use more stuff, either for our personal consumption, to invest in our businesses and grow our businesses, or our government is, you know, running a large deficit, then we are going to have to come up with the stuff that we didn't produce from somewhere else. Sometimes, you know, we could have produced that, and we were in some kind of recession. Lately, though, you know, we've pretty much been operating the economy up until maybe 3 or 6 months ago, pretty much full tilt. So really, in that case, I think it was the, you know, large amount of stuff that, as consumers, businesses, and governments, we've wanted to use, and we had to import stuff to fill the gap.
Well, I there's something you said earlier that it hasn't been bugging me, but I was thinking it was kind of funny that you were saying that we could go out and buy other countries, invest in other countries. But it's funny how much other countries want to invest in us. So who's fooling who here? I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't expect that to happen.
Is that a concern to you, Arthur, about either other companies from other countries or other countries themselves, the sovereign wealth funds?
I don't worry about other countries owning parts of our country. That means they're in it with us. They want us to succeed. They don't want us to do poorly. I'm sure there's a military strategic level on all that as well, but I don't go there.
So you think it's a good thing to have partners in debt?
Sure. I mean, that's going to kind of hedge our risk there. If we spread the debt out across the world, it should be a lot nicer for us, at least, if something goes wrong.
Well, let me ask you this. Well, what would they get out of it? I mean, what makes America attractive, even though it's a debt situation, would make it attractive for our friends abroad to invest in us? And, Eric, I'm just going to ask you on that, if you'd start.
Well, even though we've spent a lot of time today talking about uncertainty, the United States is still a proven winner as far as the economy goes. And so long run, we don't see any major problems in the long run. The United States economy will be competitive for decades. All of your working lives, I think, we don't have to worry about much. So in the terms of going to a safe place that where you know there will be long run growth, I think that's one reason.
I think I'd say that in response to Arthur, excuse me, really very much it is about diversification. If I were an investor in France, I would want to have some money in the United States markets, some money in the European markets, some in Japan, some in the emerging markets. Likewise, as an investor in the United States, I want to have my money spread over many different economies so that essentially when one's up, the other one might be down and vice versa. So I'm spreading my bets on exactly that concern. I think that in addition to that, I would also want to say back to the issue of depreciation of currency. Generally we think that you want to take both into account. You want to take both the rate of return you're going to get in mm-hmm. someone's market mm-hmm. and the currency change. Mm-hmm. And so typically, if we do expect the dollar to fall farther, we might consider investing in another market when we otherwise wouldn't be able to. I think I would essentially agree with much of what Eric said. The United States has a stable and, in the grand scheme of things, very clean government. Mm-hmm. People come from many other countries and go, wow, this is surprisingly clean. The garbage actually does get hauled away. We don't have people blocking the roads with tractors. Mm-hmm. We don't have, policemen or people at the DMV extorting you for a bribe. Whereas you go to many other countries and, every interaction with, a potential government official might be an opportunity for a bribe to be extracted. And I bet probably no one in here has ever had a bribe extracted from them from a public official in the United States, mm-hmm. which would be absolutely, routine in many other countries. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that we have a mechanism for, I wouldn't want to use the term quality control, but check and balance on procedure. So that things get done above board.
Yeah, and that goes for although there are mm-hmm. tremendous problems mm-hmm. with the corporate sector mm-hmm. as well, and mm-hmm. many people not acting in the interests of mm-hmm. their shareholders, mm-hmm. to me, it's almost always surprising once you think about it mm-hmm. how rare that mm-hmm. malfeasance is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How rarely people ask for some kind of kickback mm-hmm. when they're going to make a sale mm-hmm. or something like that. So the fact that we do have a relatively clean, mm-hmm. non-corrupt, mm-hmm. legal and social mm-hmm. institution mm-hmm. makes it a very attractive place mm-hmm. to do business. Mm-hmm. Although our education and skills could always be better, we have a well-educated, well-trained workforce. Mm-hmm. We read a lot, say, for instance, about India or China producing tremendous amounts mm-hmm. of engineers. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the actual testing levels of those people, mm-hmm. it's often that only 30% of them would, say, for instance, mm-hmm. be able to qualify mm-hmm. for an engineering degree mm-hmm. to the standards of a fully developed country.
You've just insulted a third of the world's
population. I have. Well, I don't think it's...
Oh,
it's
watch out.
You know,
you got America against you, and now you got India.
I don't think there's any shame in a country that is less wealthy having a hard time producing as many qualified engineers.
And I'd like to actually cut right to Brooke here, because she did share with me that business is her pathway. Do you feel that the fact that transparency is built into our quote-unquote Bill of Rights in terms of business practices, that makes America a safe bet even in times of trouble?
I'm actually my pathway is actually math, and I haven't taken any business classes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe that was Julie behind the camera. But anyway, could you just speak to that?
America's a great place to be, and a lot of jobs being offshored and outsourced to other countries might hurt my chances of getting a job here in the U.S., but I don't know.
We're still the land of innovation, and we're still the ones that are making all the medical breakthroughs, and it's still a great place to be. Things are still happening. We're not... Things are still happening. Things are being discovered. Okay. We're changing things still.
Well, I would like to interject here as an AmeriCorps service learning student who's been doing community projects for 2.5 years. I have to say that there's a lot to be said for Yankee ingenuity. I think we do come up with great ideas, and because we are a nation of nations, this is really the best place to launch that idea and get the support. What we have in this country is infrastructure, and with infrastructure, you can move forward. And as I said, I'm going to be doing a project in a third world country, which is what they need from us as a delegation coming from Humboldt State, is that infrastructure know-how. So I know people are a little shaky, they hear things in the news, but America does it best when it comes to not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but turning that wheel. And we're very strong on that. And I think the Humboldt State University is strong, and the Econ Department is excellent. It's a small department, but we got what it takes. So don't be frightened when you see the stock market going up and down, and when you hear about foreclosures and whatnot. We as a country can ride it out. And that, quite frankly, is what puts us head and shoulders, in my opinion, above the rest in the world. And I believe in America. I think it's a great country to grow up in and to live in, and it's worth fighting for. So take your dollar, make it work, and stick with it, folks. And I think we're going to close on that unless we have any other comments.
I just wanted to get one last plug in on that theme, actually. Locally, students at Humboldt State and College of the Redwoods have a tremendous opportunity to participate in becoming a wealth creator and becoming someone who drives economic change and social development in this county through the Economic Fuel business plan competition, which is open to all CR and Humboldt State students, and people can win up to $25,000 of startup capital for their business if one of their business plans is one of the winners.
And where would we find more information?
We would find more information about that at www.economicfuel.org.
Excellent.
I wanted to thank you, Dawn, and Julie behind the camera there for really organizing this and putting this together. That was wonderful. Also, I'd like to thank Brooke and Arthur for participating. I enjoyed hearing your take and your student viewpoints on stuff, on all the interesting stuff we talked about today. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and Julie is my partner in crime. She's behind the camera. She's the one with the business pathway. I'm sorry. But anywho, we're all together on this. And we want to thank you for listening to us, and we hope that you liked listening and looking at us, and we prepared for you. And this is really our legacy to the community, and we want you to know that you're in this too. Thank you so much, and good night.